months, the Trump administration has claimed that the decision to add the citizenship question was made at the department level rather than at the White House. But now the president is asserting executive privilege over all of these documents. This begs the question, what is being hidden?
Elijah Cummings, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, had a hearing today on whether to hold Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt. They have refused to hand over documents about the proposed citizenship question on the next census. And today, President Trump invoked executive privilege to block the release of those documents. Joining us now to talk about Trump's power to invoke that privilege is John Michaels. He's a constitutional law professor at UCLA. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, this is a hot political topic, this census citizenship question, because the Supreme Court is currently deciding on it and has about a couple of weeks to issue its decision. Do you know what these documents are that the president doesn't want to hand over?
So obviously we don't know the specific details, but the concern and the reason what motivates the interest here is that there might have been discussions, particularly between the Commerce and Justice Department, about how an additional question put on the census form might encourage or discourage, I should say, certain communities from announcing themselves and being counted, which matters for a voter election districting and for fully recognizing particularly Black and Brown communities and their numbers in the American polity. And the concern is that there was the motivation of adding a citizenship question was specifically to suppress those voices.
Right. And so the Justice Department is saying, no, this is in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act to protect the rights of minorities. And lower courts have really been skeptical of that argument and have ruled against the Justice Department. But it does appear that the Supreme Court, they're leaning towards believing the Justice Department on this, right?
It's always hard to figure out what the court's going to do ahead of time. This court, regardless of the politics of the moment, seems comfortable with broad assertions of executive power. At the same time, this Supreme Court also seems concerned about administrative power and about allowing too much deference to agencies in their decision making. So it's really not obvious how the court will come down on the merits here, at least to me.
Let's talk about this executive privilege invoked today. The president decided to assert it and say, no, we're not going to hand over these documents. Is there anyone that says to him before he does that, no, you can't do that? This is part of the job of Congress to request and review these documents.
Yeah, ideally. And I don't think it's even such a high ideal to hope for. I mean, just general practice in situations where the president wants to conceal as much as possible of the deliberative process. And that's understandable. But there has to be a kind of a give and take. The public has a right to know. Congress needs to know. Congress has a constitutional right to know and an obligation to know. So usually what would happen in a situation like this is the president kind of asks for the moon and the folks around him or her would say, well, you know, this is not exactly how you can invoke executive privilege. It usually pertains to matters of national security, which this really isn't. It usually has to do with sensitive White House deliberations, which, again, this doesn't seem to be. It seems to be about discussions between two agencies. And hopefully in that situation, folks in the Justice Department and folks in the White House counsel would be treading a little bit more carefully than we've seen this administration do from pretty much day one. So the first step would simply be to tone down the rhetoric and hope for at the very least a negotiated settlement where some information is turned over to Congress, but not all information. That's usually how these things work out.
But in this case, that's not happening.
In this case, as in seemingly other cases that feel a lot like this one, we don't have what I think a lot of folks of the commentariat would call adults in the room. There doesn't seem to be much of a commitment to maintaining the high standards that that used to apply to the Justice Department and even in most circumstances the White House counsel's office.
Well, isn't this an interesting situation in that the people who would normally be giving him advice on executive privilege are in the Justice Department, but in this case, the Justice Department is involved in this very question, in this very issue that we just discussed that's before the Supreme Court, and also this very issue of whether or not its justification for adding the census question was legally justifiable, was accurate in terms of enforcing the Voting Rights Act. So is there a conflict of interest here?
Yeah, that's a great point. And what one would hope is that the fact that the Justice Department was in from day one was they would kind of have intervened right away with the Commerce Department and say, hey, this looks a little fishy. If indeed the allegations of what's contained in these documents is at all accurate, and that the Justice Department from day one should have been saying, this seems like an effort at voter suppression, or this seems to be informed by, you know, there seems to be some racial animus motivating this. Let's really tread carefully. So they did have that moment to intervene. When they didn't intervene at that point, I think you're right, they're much less likely to be kind of fair brokers, honest brokers in this context. And again, it also the Justice Department is under scrutiny by Congress on a number of grounds. So they may want to just put up a unified front and invoke an overarching executive privilege in this case in order to insulate themselves from any number of other inquiries that both the House Judiciary Committee and other committees are looking at that also touch upon potential improprieties that have been, if not perpetrated by the Justice Department, that the Justice Department has been kind of complicit in.
Right. And so the House yesterday voted to hold Attorney General Barr and Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, in contempt for failing to comply with these other subpoenas. So can a person, namely the Attorney General, be held in contempt repeatedly for multiple issues?
Presumably. We don't see this much. So, you know, there's not a lot of case law here. There's not a lot of standoffs that actually get to this point. As I said, usually, if not cooler heads prevailing, they arrive at some begrudging settlement. It is possible that we see multiple counts of contempt. Then the question becomes, will this be brought to the courts? Will the courts require essentially enjoin the officials in order to no longer be in contempt to provide the information that Congress requested in the first place? And we've seen a little of that already with subpoenas for the president's financial documents. That went to the district court in Washington, D.C. And in that case, which was a few months ago, the court did say, no, you have to turn over these documents. Okay. That was a private party holding in that case,
right?
The Attorney General.
But in this case, I guess the question would work its way up to the Supreme Court, right? Whether or not the president has to turn over these documents related to the census. But that's the case the court itself is deciding. So doesn't the court itself have a conflict of interest in a way?
Not necessarily. I mean, we do see these. There's what's called the merits of the case. And that's currently the litigation that you refer to in our kind of the opening to our conversation, which is this question, regardless of the circumstances upon which it was arrived at, this question on the census form, is it kosher under the standards of the way the statute is written and our understandings of what an agency has to do to act in a non-arbitrary, non-capricious fashion. But then there's these kind of other questions, which are, you know, was the procedure that was used to arrive at that question, was that itself kosher? And in this case, was their process somehow tainted by considerations of things that are unconstitutional, as it were? I don't think of it as a conflict per se. It's something that courts have to deal with regularly. There are potentially other issues with the court and the fact that two members of the court are recent Trump appointees that, you know, one could speculate on. But I don't think that's really at issue in this particular case.
UCLA constitutional law professor John Michaels, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, La Luz del Mundo. Its leader is sitting in jail here, accused of sex crimes. We'll look at how this church became so popular in the Mexican immigrant community here. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. La Luz del Mundo Church has come under scrutiny after its leader was arrested last week on multiple charges of sex abuse. Nason Joaquin Garcia, who heads the church, is currently sitting in an L.A. County jail awaiting trial, his bond set at $50 million. La Luz del Mundo was founded back in the 1920s in Mexico. It now claims to have more than 5 million followers, much of its growth coming from churches here in the United States. Well, joining us to talk about the case and the church is Layla Miller, reporter for the L.A. Times. Hi, Layla.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Mary Puckett, who wrote her PhD dissertation about the church at the University of Florida. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Okay, Layla, remind us what the charges are, and other people are also being accused of wrongdoing in relation to this case, right?
There are a couple other people. So the charges are against Mr. Garcia, who's the apostle of the church, and then three women who are members of the church. The church has said that they were congregants. There are 26 felonies, and those include human trafficking, production of child pornography, the rape of a minor. And prosecutors said that they happened in L.A. County between 2015 and 2018. So the complaint has, you know, some disturbing details about how these women who are charged helped prepare young girls for the pleasure of the apostle.
Oh, wow. So they would basically find these girls and allegedly deliver them to him?
So one incident in the complaint, for example, says that one of the women called a girl to the apostle's home and asked her to serve him coffee in his office without wearing any clothing. And then when the girl entered his office, the complaint says that he put his arms around her, he kissed her on the lips, and he touched her in intimate areas.
Hmm. And Attorney General, California Attorney General Javier Becerra, he held a news conference talking about this case, and he set the bail really high, $50 million.
So he was worried that these congregants would fundraise to help pay the bail and let and then the apostle would leave the country.
Oh, wow. So I assume that his followers are defending him. They don't believe that he has done anything wrong.
The followers that I have spoken to have defended him. They say that he is innocent and that they have heard, you know, many of his sermons. They know his character. They've heard him preach about the value of family, and they do not believe these charges were true. They can't imagine how they could be true.
Mary, over to you. Talk a little bit about who this man is and how he fits into the history of the church.
So Apostle Nason is the third in a line of succession of apostles since the church's founding, as you said, in the 1920s. It's all been in the same family. The apostleship has all been in the same family so far. Church members will say that that's just a coincidence, that God just happens to have a very blessed family, and that it's not about succession. But Nason is the third. He has only recently come into power, well, relatively recently come to the apostleship. In the last, like, maybe 2 or 3 years, his father, Samuel, passed away, which was a total blow to church members as well. And he was shortly thereafter named apostle.
And this is a church that is an offshoot of Catholicism, or it incorporates some aspects of Catholicism with some other aspects? Mm-hmm. How would you describe it?
It is not related to Catholicism. It's its own denomination. They try to distinguish themselves from Catholicism, although many of their practices are similar to practices that happen in traditional Catholic churches still today. Traditional Catholic women will wear veils when they go into church, et cetera. But this church has, from the get-go, tried to distinguish itself from Catholicism. You know, at first it tried to market itself as a distinctly Mexican church, but as the church desired to grow, in order to fuel its membership, it kind of has started to adopt this more cosmopolitan image of a church of the world and not just a church for Mexico. And that has kind of helped facilitate its growth outside Mexico.
But they believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior?
For them, Jesus is an apostle of God, the same way that Nesson is apostle of God. So
He's considered equivalent to Jesus Christ?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
For them, there was an apostleship that took kind of a hiatus with Jesus, but then with the church's founder, that apostleship was reinstated by God. And so the only true apostle on earth is Nesson.
He is presented as a godlike figure.
They won't say that he's God, but that he has a special connection to God, the same way that Jesus did.
Well, so 5 million followers, that's not a small number. How did it become so popular?
Well, the 5 million figure, you know, that could be disputed. You know, all kinds of denominations inflate their membership. But the church's message is extremely powerful, and the church offers a lot of practical resources that especially immigrants really need when they move to a new place. And so the church's networks are very strong. You know, you can be an immigrant and move if you're a member of the church, or even if you're not a member of the church, you can convert as an immigrant to a Luzondo congregation, and you'll immediately have access to a network of people who can provide you with childcare, help you find a job, help you learn English, et cetera. So there are all kinds of practical benefits to belonging to this church. Men don't drink or gamble, and so congregants are able to save money and succeed in a lot of ways that they may not have been able to otherwise.
Is there a strict division between men and women in the church?
Yes, men and women have very distinct roles within the church. They sit on opposite sides of the congregation. You know, women can only sort of be preachers for women's only services, which, you know, most churches, I think, have once a week. So women don't hold positions at the pulpit, but they can be like choir directors or participate in the choir, and they do all kinds of other church-related work. But it's an interesting case study because, you know, as you've probably seen, when men and women encounter or even sometimes just think about the apostle, both men and women will break into tears and become very emotional. And from my observations, men participate often in child-rearing, and, you know, they're not afraid to be hands-on. So in some ways, it's a strict division of labor, but in other ways, it encourages some men to be less maybe masculine or less of a machismo character that maybe is assumed.
Yeah. What about the money aspect of it? Is there tithing involved? How does the church make money?
So the church makes money in a lot of different ways. Yes, there is tithing involved at every service. And there are often special donations that are asked for by the congregation, usually to fund so that apostle will go on these strange like tours of the world where he goes to all the congregations throughout the world to make appearances. And that's all funded by church members. But they also do extracurricular work to raise money for the church. They can sell tamales. They sell, you know, crafts at craft fairs and flea markets, et cetera. So they're almost constantly working to raise money for the church. And where exactly it goes and who deals with the money, I don't know.
So these allegations, what will that do to the church? Is this going to significantly damage it, do you think?
You know, I don't know. This church works very hard to cultivate a positive image. You know, they have these very striking church buildings to sort of let everyone know how successful they are. And church members are very polite and very welcoming of newcomers. And that's a part of cultivating this image of respectability. And these charges will really damage that. Whether or not this inhibits the church's growth, I don't know. I genuinely don't think that any of the congregants will ever accept these charges as true. So I'm not sure that this will necessarily affect them and their beliefs.
But who's going to lead the church now?
That's a good question. I don't know. There's a select group of people who surround the apostle and who kind of surround the apostleship, and they are the ones who... They wouldn't say that they make this decision. They would say that God makes the decision to appoint a new apostle. But it's a real mystery as to what comes next, and it'll be interesting to see what unfolds.
Mary Puckett, she wrote her PhD dissertation on La Luz del Mundo, The Light of the World. Layla Miller, reporter for the LA Times, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how to fix climate change before it's too late.
Carbon can be used to make a lot of things, so it's a huge innovation. In fact, direct air capture will disrupt the fossil fuel industry in the sense that everything that's dug up, we don't have to do that anymore. You just suck it out of the sky and turn it into fuel.
Ideas to reverse global warming next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 12 years ago, director Lila Connors teamed up with Leonardo DiCaprio to produce the documentary The 11th Hour.
The evidence is now clear. Industrial civilization has caused irreparable damage. Our political and corporate leaders have consistently ignored the overwhelming scientific evidence.
Well, that movie drove home the point that climate change endangers our very existence on this planet. Well, the duo is back now with a follow-up of sorts to The 11th Hour. It's called Ice on Fire. This film, though, offers a glimmer of hope. It profiles a growing number of people who are trying to reverse climate change.
We have actually discovered how to pull carbon out of the atmosphere.
We extract CO2 from the air and permanently remove it by turning it into rock.
When you scale this up, our kelp farms can feed the world.
30,000 square miles of solar could power the entire United States.
Ice on Fire debuted on HBO last night. Director Lila Connors joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, great to have you. All right, so it's been 12 years since your last movie. It seems that, well, people are still actually debating whether climate change is man-made or if it exists. And it seems like on the national level, on policy level, things haven't really changed that much. Is that surprising to you?
No, it's not surprising because we've had a very active climate denial industry in the United States that has been quite frankly very successful and slowed down change. The good news is that a lot of people haven't listened to that, and actually outside of the political arena, there are a lot of people looking for the solutions and also finding the solutions, innovating. And alongside that, there's scientists that, as we see in the film, have been working for 30 years and more researching and collecting the data, proving that, yes, it's human-caused, yes, it's getting worse, and yes, we have to fix it.
Right. And so I want to focus on the positive part.
Absolutely.
All the people that you interviewed who are actually trying to figure out a solution to this. And it seems like people are pretty optimistic that technology can save us.
Well, I'll start first with nature can save us and technology. So what's really interesting about the world is that we live inside a carbon cycle, and that's what our film's about. It's really carbon up, carbon down. And the earth works that way, and we live inside that. And nature, trees, kelp, soil, organic soils sequester carbon and hold carbon in the soil, in the deep rock formations, in the ocean. And as we put fertilizer on soil, as we cut down the trees, as we cut down the kelp, nature can't help us as much as it could. So that's the first message we want to put across, is that nature is here to help us. Let's get out of its way. Let's support nature. The next exciting thing for a lot of people is that technology is catching up to nature. And we've created now, two engineers in Zurich created a machine that can suck carbon out of the air and turn it into rock.
Wow.
So we can actually pull it all out and put it in the ground.
Well, let's play a clip of tape from this company. This is from the guy who's running it. As you say, it's called ClimeWorks, and it's based in Zurich, Switzerland.
This plant will allow to close a carbon cycle. So, of course, the CO2 goes into the greenhouse and goes to the tomatoes and cucumbers. And once we eat them, the CO2 goes back to the atmosphere. But since we recapture the CO2 from the atmosphere, it's a closed cycle. So this can be a missing piece of the pie in order to close a global carbon cycle in the energy or transportation sector.
Okay, so from what I understand, the plant, this machine, actually literally sucks carbon out of the air, the atmosphere, I should say, and then turns it into something solid.
Well, it can. What's exciting about this machine and what's exciting about carbon is that carbon can be used to make a lot of things. So it's a huge innovation. In fact, direct air capture will disrupt the fossil fuel industry in the sense that everything that's dug up, we don't have to do that anymore. You just suck it out of the sky and turn it into fuel. So it's like recycling aluminum cans. That said, we have legacy carbon in the sky. We have 1.4 trillion tons of carbon in the sky that we put in since the Industrial Revolution. So that has to be sequestered permanently in the ground. And we can do that over time. And that's what that same machine can take carbon and turn it into rock and put in the basalt rock formation in Iceland, which is what they are doing. First ever in human history, they turned it on last year. Or you can take it and make fuel. You can make chairs. You can make fertilizer. You can do whatever it is that you want to do with carbon. So really the big message is you don't need to dig it up anymore. You just don't. Right now, the cost is still high because it was just invented. But trust me, over time, very quickly, the efficiencies will match and then beat the cost of fossil fuels.
But if you use it as a fuel, doesn't it then re-emit carbon into
yes,
the atmosphere?
But you're not adding more to the load in the sky. Uh-huh. And that's what our emergency is right now. We're in a climate emergency. We only have 8 years left to add to that load in the sky. So that's what's so fascinating. We have a budget. If you have a bucket and you're filling it up, we have 8 years left until that bucket is full, which means that full level is going past the Paris Agreement of 1.5 degrees.
And what happens when it's full?
What happens when it's full is that we have a load of carbon in the sky that causes the Arctic to melt. It causes methane to get released into the sky. It causes the web of life to start falling apart. It's happened 5 times in the past geologically. So we just need to stay under certain levels. And this is not really in dispute. This is kind of in the geologic record. They can see what happens when carbon spikes in the atmosphere, the web of life collapses. So we have to stay below certain levels of carbon.
So apparently we need about 300,000 of these facilities to capture 1% of
yes.
CO2 emissions?
Well, in the current efficiency. So all they're saying is, listen, we have the ability to scale in an industrial manner that actually makes sense. But again, our film isn't relying on technology. We're really relying on a combination of things, trees, kelp, soil. In fact, Drawdown, Paul Hawken, who's in the film, worked with a bunch of scientists to come up with 80 solutions to draw down carbon and to fix this problem.
And drawdown means taking it out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, drawdown also really means the bending of the carbon curve. So right now, with business as usual, we're just burning carbon into the sky and it just gets more. It's filling up that bucket. Drawdown simply means we're just literally taking it out of the bucket. We're pulling it out of the sky and we're not adding to. So renewable energy, incredibly important because we don't add to the load in the sky. And technologies that pull the carbon out of the sky is incredibly important because we're pulling it back out. We're reversing it. We're literally reversing what we did in the last 150 years. And so, yeah, that's where we're at.
But how much could these machines, the sucking of the carbon out, how much could that change?
Well, they can, again, 1% of global emissions is 300,000 machines. That said, I was talking to them recently, and they're only working on efficiencies. So it could increase over time. So we don't know, like in 5 years, it's just like solar panels. In 5 years, how many machines do we need? I don't know, because they might be incredibly powerful then. but, you know, they can actually help mitigate our emissions for sure. 9% of kelp, though, in global oceans reduces 50% of global emissions.
9% of kelp?
9% of global waters planted with kelp will reduce 50% of our emissions.
Because it's absorbing the CO2?
It's the most powerful plant on Earth in terms of sucking in carbon.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So are people planting kelp forests?
Yes. And we ask that people join to plant more. And in fact, we're going to create an initiative in the fall called Now Drawdown, which will help people participate in planting trees, kelp. I think it's a global effort that we can all get involved with.
I wanted to play another clip, speaking of the kelp, of this fisherman in your documentary. His name is Bren Smith, and he used to be a commercial fisherman until he saw what was happening to the fisheries. They were being depleted, and he has changed to become a kelp planter and an oyster farmer.
When I realized this wasn't sustainable, I went on this search for sustainability. I remade myself as an oysterman. And what oysters taught me was that Mother Nature created these technologies millions of years ago designed to mitigate our harm. We don't need advanced technologies. Mother Nature has seaweeds and shellfish, which sequester 5 times more carbon than land-based plants, filter 50 gallons of water a day per oyster, pulling nitrogen out of our system. I mean, my job as a steward of the ocean is to take Mother Nature's technologies and grow them. And it's pretty simple.
And so he talks about the kelp not only sucking in CO2, but also being used to feed cows, which is pretty extraordinary. So cows like to eat seaweed?
Yeah. And what's fascinating about kelp and what's fascinating about what Bren's doing is it's a multifaceted solution to many things. So it draws down carbon, it mitigates the methane emissions from cows, but it also feeds the world. It also provides green jobs. So his initiative now is to link inner cities with kelp farming. So it allows for people who don't have an industry to have one. And that's his big effort now, is to link people with this and help get them started.
So that could work here in LA.
100%. In fact, I'm trying to help him get them out here to start putting some in the ocean. He will be out here again. And so I think LA could have a lot of kelp farms out there.
But definitely. Getting back to the cows.
Yes.
So the idea is that if they eat kelp, they're not producing methane, which is more destructive than
CO2. And cows in general, we don't go into cows that much. I mean, of course, a vegetarian diet is preferable. That said, cows properly farmed or hoofed animals sequester 3 times more carbon than they produce, because their hoofs turn over the soil, they fertilize the soil. Mm. So the way we farm cows is what's causing the methane problem, not the cow itself.
So it's what they're eating.
It's what they're eating. It's how they're farmed. Industrial farming should be eliminated. You know, the cow as an entity, as an animal in and of itself, is not a methane-producing animal in the way that it is now.
Another solution is planting more trees, redwoods in particular. And I didn't know that redwoods are the most efficient carbon-capturing tree on the planet.
Yes, and because they're so large, I think it's pretty fundamentally interesting that large and fast-growing plants are the things that sequester carbon the most, because that carbon is what they're using to grow their bodies, grow their matter. And what's interesting about redwoods is they're resistant to the bark beetle. They're also resistant to fire. They also hold whole rivers in their root system, so they can hold water. So we really need our forests back.
The problem with redwoods is it takes many, many years, hundreds of thousands of years to grow a redwood. And we don't, as you say, we have 8 years.
Well, again, they're one of many things that we can use. And as they're growing, they're using carbon. And some people are looking into the dynamics of young forests, and they are also greatly carbon sequestering entities. So we really have to look at this as a multi-layered effort across all of our ecosystems and all of our processes. And I think that's what's so exciting, because there's a lot of innovation right there.
Do you ever feel, though, that, you know, technology is what got us into this position in the first place?
Yes.
There is a dark side to inventions and technology and whatever humans create that maybe we're not seeing, because we are so hopeful that we can reverse this.
Yeah, I agree that technology without a moral backbone is difficult, and that's why we need a vibrant civil society. We need education. We need, you know, a discussion around what we're doing with our technology. Right now, I don't think we have enough discussion around what we invent. But like I keep saying, nature is our first line of defense, and we need to support soil. We need to support trees and kelp and things like that. So we really need to work inside nature. Now, if you can, like, I know that climate scientists have looked at direct air capture machines, and they like this because it isn't interfering with any, it's not interfering with any natural system. It's its own machine. It works with renewable energy. It's made with existing parts. It's made with a shipping container. Any college-educated engineer can put it together. It doesn't have a big footprint. So that's why we highlighted it, because it's small, it's nimble. So yeah, technology, the faith in technology to fix this is I think, misguided. Hmm. But it is a part, and we shouldn't discourage people from looking at technology that works with nature.
Lila Connors, her new documentary is called Ice on Fire. You can watch it on HBO now. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, well, we spoke about redwoods in the last segment, which would soak up some CO2. Rich and powerful men like to cavort among them every year in Northern California. How the Bohemian Club earned the wrath of female lawmakers. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In San Francisco, there's a club where rich and powerful men gather, mainly conservative, very conservative men. They've been gathering there for, about 150 years. It's called the Bohemian Club. And every summer, these guys, and they are all guys, well, they let their hair down a few hours north of the city in the glampiest of glamp grounds. It's called the Bohemian Grove, nestled amongst the redwoods. They drink a lot. They put on plays to entertain each other. And, of course, they network. Notable attendees have included Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Bush Sr., the Koch brothers. Well, this annual retreat usually keeps an extremely low profile. Not this year, though. This year, the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors is majority female. And when a contract came up to provide local police services to the retreat, the all-male retreat, the board spoke out against the club and its request for law enforcement to provide security. And that controversy has made news nationwide. Mary Callahan is a reporter for the Press Democrat in Sonoma County. She joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, well, describe what the Bohemian Grove is. I mean, it's hard to do, right? Because very few people actually get to see it who aren't members of the club.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are a lot of people in the community who have worked there over the years and people who have attended. But, you know, they're not telling a lot about it to the public in general. But, you know, we certainly know the area. It's a beautiful region along the lower Russian River that's just filled with redwood trees and scenic vistas. And so we can kind of get a notion of what it might be like inside there.
And so what are they doing there?
I don't think we know. There are individual camp groups with names and members and who bring their guests up each year. And I think each one has its own culture and kind of vibe. And this is a group that started among artists and musicians and poets and writers and things. And so, you know, there are still groups that cater to, I think, a more sort of bohemian, for lack of a better word, kind of individual. And then there are those that are much more political, much more government oriented. And then those that are much more corporate. And this is sort of our understanding of it. And so we don't really know what it's like. It's not really entirely clear how much togetherness or cohesiveness there is among the entire club. This is sort of conjecture based on reports that have come out and leaked out over the decades. Yeah. But
right. So some 2,500 people apparently are members of it. But it's shrouded in such secrecy and mystery. Why is that? Why is it such a secretive place?
Well, I guess I don't entirely know. I mean, I suppose at the beginning that was sort of the fun of it.
Yeah.
And I guess if you're a very powerful individual, you like to maintain that kind of privacy. The assertion is that they leave the trappings of everyday life behind when they go in. There's this motto that's posted or attached to the building in San Francisco that doesn't have many markings or signage or anything on it that indicates it's a Bohemian Club building, but it says something like "Weaving Spiders, Here Don't Go" or something like that. And they have this ceremony at the beginning of the encampment that's has to do with the cremation of care, where they leave the cares of everyday life behind when they go in, and supposedly they don't network in there, and they're there to have a good time and to, you know, depart from the worries of everyday life. I don't know why they do the secrecy, but supposedly
it's a mystery. You can leave it at that because it's so
a
secret.
Mystery. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But what's not secret is that it's all male, and that's what's caused this year's controversy. At the Board of Supervisors meeting, two women, Shirley Zane and Linda Hopkins, made pretty strong arguments against approving this law enforcement contract. What was the outcome of that hearing and those arguments?
Well, so the question that was raised had to do with, you know, contracting with an organization that excludes women. There are myriad public events in Sonoma County and everywhere else in California where events occur where it's clear that there will be extra patrols or extra law enforcement potentially needed. You know, we have marathons, we have big bicycle rides, we have markets and things in our community where the organizers will pay the CHP or the local police department or what have you a certain sum of money to have a certain number of officers on standby in the event they are needed. And so it was the same kind of contract that the Bohemian Club has habitually reached with Sonoma County to obtain deputies, basically to be in their parking lot and at their entryways to make sure, for the most part, that no one has tried to enter or trespass or that there have been no protests that have gotten out of hand, because there are, you know, routinely a handful of protesters, and sometimes there have been rather large demonstrations at the Grove. And so the question was, is it legal for us to contract with an organization that discriminates against women? And then the broader question is, you know, how do we feel about this? Do we want to contract with an organization that discriminates against women? So the women, Shirley Zane, who raised this question at the board meeting, and then others who agreed with her, decided to postpone the decision until they could get a ruling from their county council about whether it was legal to do so. Mm-hmm. And that opinion was returned to them, and they voted to make it public yesterday. And basically the county council said, yes, you can do this because, you know, they're, as a private club under the right of assembly, the civil rights laws, the federal and the more constricting state civil rights laws, do not prevent them from discriminating against women.
And then they also said, well, since the club's going to pay for it themselves, it's not use of taxpayer money, so
And then that was the other issue, is that, you know, the law obligates the sheriff's department to respond if there were something that occurred that required law enforcement presence or investigation or enforcement of the law, say a skirmish or something that occurred there. The sheriff's department would have to send deputies to deal with that situation. And this is a pretty sensitive issue along the Russian River, where you have these small rural communities. And so this is a, particularly for Supervisor Linda Hopkins, who represents that area, this is a priority issue for her constituents. They always want more deputies. They're always in need of more patrol deputies, and the county isn't able to provide what her constituents are asking for.
So my question is, why doesn't this club, which is full of wealthy individuals, why don't they just provide their own security?
Well, they do have security within the club, but that sort of question came up. I mean, there was a point where Linda, you know, said during her rather fiery remarks at the board meeting yesterday, if they need more people to provide security, and she said something about if they needed someone to be able to provide lethal force, I'm sure they have the connections and the money to do it. Something to that effect.
Yeah.
And so that's her question, I think, going forward is, we don't have an endless supply of deputies. So even if they're paying for it, it may not be to the public benefit for us to supply them.
So yeah, and a reminder that this is a community devastated by fire a few years ago, has some meth
flooding. They've just been hit by massive flooding 2 months ago.
Yeah, so they need all the help they can get from law enforcement and other services. So how long does this festival in the woods take place?
I believe it is 19 days, July
19
10th
days?
To July 28th. It's July 10th to July 28th.
Okay, so
and it happens every year, and there's this, you know, this big influx of private jets that come into the Sonoma-Kennedy Airport. A lot of people, and there is a variety show that members of the Grove put on to benefit certain public nonprofits, and it takes place in Monterio that members of the public can attend. But otherwise, you know, it kind of happens, and a lot of people in Monterio and in the river area don't really notice that much. A lot of people take advantage of the sort of, you know, entry-level jobs. A lot of people don't notice that much, and then a lot of people sort of are ruffled by it. There's, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very interesting mix of responses and opinions about what goes on there.
What is the most ruffling aspect of it? The fact that it is male only, or the fact that it's really, really rich people descending on this community that's having economic problems?
I think it is less about wealth and more about power, and the fact that people with great power and great wealth are mixing behind the trees and talking about who knows what, and there's concern about what decisions and policy decisions and what interactions may be occurring between, you know, corporate entities and moneyed entities and government decision makers. I mean, historically, there's been, you know, a lot of corporate people in there and a lot of government policy decision, you know, cabinet members and foreign affairs decision makers. And there's been a lot of concern about that, about what decisions are being made away from where anyone can see what's happening.
Mary Callahan, reporter for the Press Democrat up in Santa Rosa. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Michelle Aloy is here now with some listener feedback. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
How are you?
I'm well. Yesterday, as you noted on Twitter, we had not one, not two, but three Emilys.
Three Emilys on the show.
Emily Alpert Reyes from the LA Times, Emily Bazelon from the New York Times Magazine, and Emily Vanderwerf from Vox. And you posed, what do we call a group of Emilys? Do we call them a riot of Emilys, a pride of Emilys? Listeners had some feedback. Let's see. We had a school of Emilys from Anthony Davis. An elegance of Emilys.
Ooh, an elegance of Emilys.
That one's a good one. That was a good one. But
like,
wait,
that one.
My personal favorite is the flamboyance of Emilys.
Yes.
Yes. Apparently that's what a group of flamingos is called, which I didn't know.
Well, they're pink.
They are pink. They're
and
quite
flamboyant.
They are. So I suppose that's a fitting name. Emily Bazelon herself said she was in favor of the riot of Emilys.
Yeah.
That's what she's for. Somebody also had an embarrassment of Emilys. That seems... No.
No.
We're not embarrassed.
There's a murder of Emilys.
There's a murder of Emilys.
I like that. Like a murder of crows.
Right. But all of the Emilys are so nice. I don't feel like we should be able to... we would call them a...
Stick with flamboyance.
A flamboyance of Emilys.
How many Michelles? They're just the one.
You might want a murder of Michelles.
I think I get that on the daily. All right. Thank you very much, Michelle Aloy. And if you want to podcast this show, you can just go to iTunes and download it for free. I'm Madeline Brand. Just one. I'll see you tomorrow.